The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. We've had the news today that Jenny Chapman is leaving her role as political secretary for the Labour leader. She's going to stay on in a different position. But Isabel, this comes after a series of changes when it comes to Keir Starmer's top team. We've had the departure of Ben Nunn, the director of communications. Morgan McSweeney, his chief of staff, has been moved to a more strategic role. Who's actually in charge now?
Well, it looks as though Keir Starmer has decided to make some changes, and that also that events just mean that some changes are happening to Keir Starmer as well. So when it comes to his comms team, Paul Ovenden, who was Ben Nunn's deputy, is leaving for family reasons rather than because he's, you know, had enough of Keir Starmer or because he's been sacked. Ben Nunn is off to pursue other projects. But with Jenny Chapman, Baroness Chapman, she was blamed by some in the party for the Hartlepool by-election defeat. Keir Starmer did keep her on at the time when he did that really botched reshuffle, which just ended up with a big story about how Angela Rayner had sort of faced him down over 24 hours and ended up with 25 million job titles. But there needs now to be a change in messaging from the leader's office, a change in direction, because otherwise it just looks as though he's rearranging the deck chairs or the desk chairs on the Titanic, and that the problem is actually him as leader. I understand they've got someone in mind for the new comms role. That currently they've got Steph Driver, who's been with the party for a very long time, in various roles, stepping up. Morgan McSweeney, who Starmer has moved but who has been insisting this is still very important, was also blamed for some of the stranger decisions that Starmer has taken over the past year and a bit, largely because he has such an emphasis on trying to keep the party together, to the extent that Starmer doesn't really define himself against anything or anyone. And that may be one of the reasons why Starmer appears to flip-flop between positions, often ends up apologising for doing perfectly anodyne things because one special interest group in the party has objected to something, and then another special interest group comes along and has a bigger, noisier petition. And so really what Starmer should now be looking for are people who can allow him to, or at least help him, to have more authority as leader and to know who he is.
James, Chapman is moving into the shadow cabinet where she will shadow David Frost. Is that going to worry David Frost?
I thought the appointment of Jenny Chapman to that job is slightly odd, considering how Keir Starmer has been so keen to de-emphasise Brexit as an issue. To put a former Remainer who campaigned for a second referendum up against David Frost, you are just inviting, I mean, it's the Lords, not the Commons, so it's not going to be quite as, it's not going to quite have the political resonance if this was across the dispatch box and House of Commons, and the Lords is a more sedate place. But it does strike of a desire to, Starmer knows he needs to move her, but he doesn't want to get rid of her entirely, and so this is the kind of compromise position that they have alighted on. I think Jenny Chapman had a difficult time. I think one of the rules of politics is that leaders' offices shouldn't get involved in by-elections unless they know that what they're going to do is going to help. And again, in Hartlepool, she was seen as being instrumental in basically ensuring that Paul Williams, a former Labour MP, another former Remainer, got the Labour nomination. I think looking at the result in Hartlepool, it's fair to say that hasn't helped. Cheshire and Amersham, I think, poses difficulties for Keir Starmer, but not for the reason some people think. I don't think he needs to worry at all about what happened to the Labour vote there. So it turns into the Tory vote and the anti-Tory vote. And actually, Labour need a certain amount of tactical voting if they are to deny the Tories a majority at the next election. I think what should worry him is the fact that the Liberal Democrats can win in these circumstances at a time when the Labour Party is extremely nervous about suffering another by-election defeat in Batley and Spen. I think it would be one thing if we were in a situation where the vaccine rollout meant that it was impossible for the opposition parties to get a look in. We're clearly not in that moment, which suggests that the crisis is more particular to the Labour Party.
Now, Isabel, elsewhere we've had a report from the Commons Education Committee and is talking about white privilege. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, this is really interesting. It's got a very eye-catching line about white privilege being something that may have held back work to improve the chances of white working class children, because it is assumed that because they are white, they can't possibly be struggling in the education system. And this has caused a big row within the Education Select Committee, with all the Labour members objecting formally in the votes that they had, just to explain, select committees, when they're producing their reports, because they're cross-party, if there's a disagreement over lines in the report or the summary of the report and so on, then they end up having votes and that will divide along party lines. And the Labour members of the committee voted against the use of the term white privilege as a criticism. And there's been a row that's then blown up around that, with MPs such as Diane Abbott saying it's another Tory attempt to sow division, and people hitting back saying, well, no, this is exactly the point, that that term is divisive and unhelpful to a group of children who are not only left behind in the education system, but ignored and have been ignored for a very long time. And the report itself is fascinating. And it does touch on a strangely overlooked area. If you talk to anyone in the education world, they will say, oh yes, white working class children are the ones who always get left behind. They often have the least parental support. They're often ignored by teachers, by initiatives that are announced by government. But nothing is done about it. And so that's why the Education Select Committee has done this lengthy inquiry on the educational chances of white working class children. But it has turned into part of the culture war, war on woke, or whatever you want to call it, that is currently enveloping our politics at the moment. And I don't know whether the attention that it has got is necessarily a good thing for the policy issue that the MPs on the committee wanted to discuss, because the risk is that it just ends up being dismissed as being an attempt to sow division by the people who should be paying attention to this within the education world.
I feel like jumping in here, but I won't.
No, it's fine. I'm just going to say Fraser. Yeah, you did it last week. You got it.
Fraser is back in his office. I'm going to bring Fraser in at this point.
I think this is not just an important issue, but one of the most important issues in politics. I've been involved with Social Mobility Foundation for quite some time, and there's no doubt that the demographic most missing in these programmes is white working class. And I think the now and again politicians will say, oh, isn't this terrible? If you look at the UCAS figures, there's no doubt that white working class boys are the category least likely to get into university than anybody else. The boys especially. The gap between male and female is almost as big as the gap between white and non-white. But we'll never be able to address this problem if we can't talk about it. And what we found out in this committee blow-up is just how much difficulty there is in even talking about the problem of white working class underachievement. Now and again, you'll see this is an agenda which, as Isabel says, is given lip service every 6 months, sometimes once a year. Theresa May on the steps of number 10 mentioned white working class as being a problem. But that will not matter not one jot unless policymakers and politicians go away and working out why. What's the problem here? Could it be to do with cultural issues? If so, how do we address them? An inability to talk about this problem will be an inability to solve it, and that will leave this demographic falling further and further and further behind. And any society that cares about social cohesion ought to talk about it. The strange thing is that it's Labour who are opting out of this. You'd think that traditionally the Labour Party ought to be the party more concerned than anybody else about championing the rights of the disadvantaged and finding a vocabulary to do it, rather than complaining about the words that other people are using to try to address this problem.
And Fraser, just on that, I mean, you interviewed Angela Rayner a while ago and she talked about this, but as you say, it was almost seen as a controversial thing that she said within the view from her party at the time.
Yeah, I think Angela Rayner is quite an admirable politician. I'm in the minority amongst my friends, and just what she's achieved in her life, I think, is huge admiration. I think she will know a lot about the problem this represents. And simply put, it's a problem of low expectations. And that's a very difficult problem to change. It's so important. And when you look at the social mobility, the meritocracy things, for example, in this country, we have got ladders that certain demographics are climbing a lot more readily and easily than others. And we have to, I think, work out that ladders are only going to take you so far. You need a lot more imaginative interventions, harder to reach people. And I think, you know, I would love for a Labour Party to be leading this discussion. The Tories have stopped caring about it now that Ian Duncan Smith isn't really to the fore. The Tories pick it up and drop it as a passing interest. I'm not really sure who speaks out for white working class families and their concerns. Robert Halfram has been quite good at talking about it, but it sort of breaks my heart to see this relegated into being some weird culture war issue. It's not that. This is the group. If it were any other colour, it would be a lot easier to talk about. But because it's white and because it's working class, everybody feels very shy, very reluctant to talk about it, that they're going to be accused of being snobbish if you're from a posh background or demeaning. So as a result, there is no discussion, no policies. I'd love for Boris to be able to change this narrative, but I don't think he's going to be able to. So weirdly, the fuss about this report, if anything, has emphasised just how bad the problem is.
And in other news, James, we have a new DUP leader.
Yes, Geoffrey Donaldson is the only candidate nominated for the DUP leadership, so we expect that the party executive will confirm him in that position. Now, there is an irony here, which is when it was Geoffrey Donaldson and Edwin Poots, the view was that Donaldson probably had enough fuel in the tank to win. In the end, he lost by one vote. He is actually in a much stronger position this time round than if he had won by one vote last time round, because Edwin Poots has essentially destroyed himself as a political force by his mishandling of his very brief 20-day stint as DUP leader. I also think Geoffrey Donaldson actually has a kind of answer to the Irish Language Act issue now, which is simply to say, well, look, the previous leader of the DUP sold a pass on this in Edwin Poots, and you've now got the Secretary of State committed to legislating on it. So I can't do anything about that. Now, what is striking is how his statement on being the only candidate nominated is all about the protocol. And basically, it's an interesting argument about the protocol, because it is coming back to essentially, and he's going to tell the Prime Minister that the protocol cannot contribute to stability in Northern Ireland when every unionist representative at Stormont is opposed to it. And I think this is one of the arguments that you will hear a lot of from Donaldson in coming weeks. And it does create a difficulty for the EU when they want to argue that, you know, the protocol is all about protecting the Good Friday Agreement. The Good Friday Agreement is all about trying to achieve kind of consensus in politics. It's clear that the protocol in its current form is not doing that. I mean, there is a broader question now about the direction in which unionism goes, to what extent Donaldson can arrest the slide of the DUP, which has been losing support to both the TUV, Traditional Unionist Voice, who are even more vehemently anti-protocol and think the DUP have been too soft on the issue, and the Ulster Unionist Party under new leadership of Doug Beattie, which is kind of pushing a more inclusive form of unionism, still very opposed to the protocol, but less socially conservative than the DUP has traditionally been. So we wait to see what Donaldson can do. And also, given that we know Donaldson wants to be First Minister, there are two interesting things to watch there. One is the by-election in his Lagan Valley constituency, what happens there, the Westminster seat. And secondly, how smoothly can you get an executive up and running? Because when Paul Givan, the short-lived current First Minister of Northern Ireland, resigns, the Deputy First Minister has to resign too, and the whole executive has to be formed over again. Does that become enough a moment of drama or not?
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening.